Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Well, in the words of Matthew McConaughey, all right, all right, all right. Welcome to the second episode of Life in the Stocks this week and the 192nd in total. Pretty amazing, isn't it? 192 episodes. There'll be 200 out there in the world by Christmas time. They're all done. They're all in the can. They're ready to go out. Two a week, every week, until Christmas. And joining me today for episode 192 is David Elifson from Megadeth. I think I'm saying the surname correct there. It's spelt funny. Elifson, Elifson. He is the bassist in Megadeth, one of the original band members, part of that classic Rust in Peace era lineup, and a great guy with loads of great stories, and we had a really good chat. You're going to love it. It's been quite a good run as of late as well. Scott Ian from Anthrax has been on the show, Dave Lombardo from Slayer, Billy Gould from Faith No More, Wayne Kramer from MC5, Rob Halford from Judas Priest, and then earlier this week, Brian Tatler from Diamondheads. So we've got a bit of a Big Four theme running throughout the show as of late as well. And to complete that run, next week on the show, I'll be joined by Michael Alago, who is the A&R guy that signed Metallica to Elektra Records back in the day. He also signed White Zombie. He worked with Cyndi Lauper, Nina Simone, The Misfits, Mina Caputo from Life of Agony. Loads of amazing projects. The story of his life is insane. There's a documentary about him on Netflix, which is called Who the Fuck Is That Guy, which I recommend watching. He's got a new book out about his life as well, which I've read, and that's great. And I'll be getting into the story of his spectacular life next week on the show. But today, this week, it's all about David Elifson from Megadeth. And we spoke about a week ago now over the phone, as we've been doing through lockdown, although Brian from Diamondhead was face to face. That was the first face to face I'd done since March, I believe. He's a local guy. He's from Stourbridge. So we met up in Birmingham at my friend's studio space, Birmingham Streams, did a socially distanced interview there. And it felt so good. I mean, not only is the sound better, but just the dynamic and the nature of the conversation is so much more intimate and personal when you're right there with the person. But the phoners have served me well this year, and it's all thanks to everybody who donates to the podcast via the Patreon page that I could afford to buy my very special Rodecaster Pro desk, which has allowed me to record these high quality phoners all throughout lockdown. So I want to say a huge thank you to all the Patreon crew for supporting this show, for chipping in every month, helping me keep the lights on and keep this show going. If you want to do the same, you can chip in just £1 a month, and that really does make a huge difference because all those pounds add up. And right now, at the moment, and for the last 9 months, that has been my sole source of income this year. So if you want to donate as well, you get all kinds of things in return. The higher up the tiers go, from bonus podcasts and archives, live interviews to DJ mixes, merch bundles. You get early access to the shows without intros or adverts. You get the chance to ask guest questions. You can ask me questions. I do weekly behind the scenes podcasts where I talk about each episode, what went on, how I got time with the guest, and all of that. So please do check out the page. Please do give what you can. Please do help support this podcast and help keep things ticking over into 2021. The address is patreon.com/ Life in the Stocks. Don't forget as well, my book is soon to be released. December the 15th is the new official release date for my first book. It's called Life in the Stocks: Voracious Conversations with Musicians and Creatives. And it is based on conversations from this podcast. This is volume one of many more. So I went back and looked at the first 12 to 18 months of the show, pulled out 35 of my favorite guests from America and Canada, and just transcribed those interviews, took out the highlights, presented them in a format which tells a new story. So each chapter is divided up into themes and topics, and we cover everything from childhood to punk rock, success, booze and drugs, politics and religion, creative partnerships, life and death, and so much more. And you can pre-order your copy today. If you do so today, it will arrive in time for Christmas as a nice stocking filler for you or indeed a friend or a loved one. And you can get the book by going to Amazon. You can find it on there, Life in the Stocks, Voracious Conversations with Musicians and Creatives. Or you can get signed copies from the Rare Bird website, which is the publishing house putting out the book. And their website is rarebirdlit.com. Do have a look at all the other books on there as well. A lot of rock and roll books, a lot of music books, novels by the likes of Sean Penn, Keith Buckley. I'm amongst very good company. And yeah, they're a great publishing house with many great titles to their name. So have a little ganders at the website, rarebirdlit.com. But let's get into my chat with David. We jumped straight in and talked about sobriety and addiction and boozing and drugging and hell raising and getting clean right from the offset. We spoke about the classic Rust in Peace era lineup and then the string of incredible albums that followed. We talk about the history of the band, the nature of David's relationship with Dave Mustaine, of course, the main man in Megadeth. We spoke about Megadeth in a lot of detail, we also spoke about the big four bands, the big four shows, the shared history of all those bands, Anthrax, Slayer, Megadeth, Metallica. We spoke about touring with Judas Priest on the Painkiller tour. So a lot of synergy and crossover happening at the moment. And we spoke all about Ellefson's new record, his covers album, which is called No Cover. It's out now and it is a hell of a lot of fun. There's loads of great guests on there. Everybody from Al Jurgensen from Ministry, to Satchel from Steel Panther, Dave Lombardo, who I mentioned a moment ago, who's been on the show recently, Charlie Benante from Anthrax. So a lot of great guests and musicians on the record. A killer track listing as well. They cover songs by the likes of AC/DC, Judas Priest, Cheap Trick, Dead Kennedys, some great songs on there. Really good album, really good fun. And yeah, it's out now. David Ellefson, No Cover. Check it out. And check this out. Whilst you're at it, listen to this. Episode 192 of Life in the Stocks with David Ellefson from Megadeth. Enjoy the show. Hey, Dave, how are you, mate?
Hey there, buddy. How are you?
I'm doing good, man. I'm happy to be talking to you.
Yeah, thank you, Matt.
We met each other briefly on Zakk Wylde's tour bus in Poland in February.
Oh, yeah. I remember that. I was DJing
on that tour with them, opening up each show, and you guys came down with some of the Death Punch crew. Obviously, you were on tour at the same time as well. And it was funny seeing you and Zakk geek out over coffee. Obviously, you both got your own strain of coffee.
We do.
And it's cool how you've got two reformed Hellraisers turned coffee nuts, you know, healthy, happy, and shifting some beans.
Yeah, we've both lived like, you know, second lives, you know. When you get cleaned up, you can enjoy your taste buds come back and you can enjoy the finer things in life, like good coffee.
And I imagine there's that still an appetite there to not raise hell and rage, but still, as you say, to like, you know, tantalize the taste buds and not just drink water.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, any good speed metal titan needs to arise to the day with a good strong cup of coffee, you know. So to me it makes sense, you know.
Well, you're also a bona fide hustler, aren't you, Dave? I mean, I've been reading through just your list of endeavors and projects outside of obviously your day job in Megadeth. We'll talk about the new record momentarily as well. But as well as the coffee company, you've got your own label. You've got a film company. Am I right in thinking that as well?
Yes. And
you've written two books.
Yeah, I've actually written four now.
And wow.
That takes you to the next one. Well, we just launched the Ellison Book Company, which is my book imprint. And the first title that'll be coming out is actually a fictional title that I wrote called Rockstar Hitman. And in some ways, it's kind of like John Grisham. I'm a big fan of him. And, of course, you know, he used to be a lawyer, so most of his books have some sort of lawyer espionage in them, you know. So I figured since I'm a rock and roller, I'll start close to home and start writing books, you know, fictional titles that are kind of close to my own career path, you know, and things that I know about in rock stardom and celebrity and that. So I figured, you know, to make a rock star, also be a hitman would be a good place to start.
I love it. Well, they say write about what you know, don't they? And so it's taking your real life experiences, transplanting it into a fictitious world of that kind of comic book anti-hero. And the two aren't a million miles away, are they? The kind of John Grisham crime spree and rock and roll.
Especially when killing is my business and business is good. You know, they kind of go hand in hand.
There you go. It goes back to where it all started.
It always does, doesn't it? Yeah.
When you're a creative person, you're a creative anyway. But let me ask you this, Dave, did you find that when you got sober and you got clean, because they say you've got nothing but time on your hands then, right? Do you find the productivity levels just go through the roof?
Yeah, and it takes a little while. I mean, you know, probably I remember there was a moment as I was getting clean, because I got sober off drugs and alcohol literally 3 weeks before we recorded the Rust in Peace album in March of 1990. And I remember there was a moment somewhere in the weeks preceding that where I was sitting on my couch in my apartment in Studio City, California, and I was just going, man, I don't even know if I want to play music anymore. And, you know, I was just sort of having these sort of, you know, doubting moments. And this thought hit me that said, you know, you started playing music when you were a kid, long before you ever tasted a drink or a drug. And you know, you did this just for the joy of doing it. And that just, thunderbolt moment, you know, really just changed everything for me, you know. And I went, God, you know what, you're right, the drugs and the booze just got in the way. You know, in the beginning they sort of enhance it, or they give you the illusion that there's an enhancement,
right?
But by the end it's always a boomerang that comes around and cuts you to pieces, you know. So and I knew better than to get involved in it, because I was raised well by good parents on a farm in Minnesota. So I mean, I certainly knew right from wrong, but you know, it's one of those things where once you sort of, you know, tap the bottle, you know, once you're in, you know. And so for me, fortunately, I'm one of the lucky few who actually got clean at age 25 and have, you know, now at age 55, have enjoyed 30 years of a wonderfully clear-headed, you know, sober, not only just personal life, but career life. And it's funny because it's almost like I'm stepping on the gas harder and driving faster and doing more now, because it's almost like the last three decades have been sort of the culmination to build upon in this moment right now. And I think that's why I have such a kind of a wide berth of all these Ellison Industries, if you will.
Well, congratulations on 30 years, man. That's a huge milestone and a huge achievement. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Done. Here's to 30 more. So you and Dave, like, were you kind of getting clean around the same time? Were you on the same trajectory in that sense? Or were you just on your own separate paths, and did his sobriety come a little later?
Yeah, it was. I mean, you know, look, the truth of it is, you know, Dave, you know, put a book out about the Rest in Peace story, and I had a big contribution in that, as well as, you know, a lot of the cast of characters who were around the organization at that time.
He put that book out, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it was nice, you know, especially for Dave and I to be able to tell that story, you know, through that book, which was cool. But, you know, there's obviously many, you know, layers of that story as well. And I mean, honestly, what you know, really the turning point was, you know, after we played Donington, Monsters Rock, in August 1988, I was extremely strung out, went home to go to rehab. You know, we canceled several shows with Iron Maiden. There were some other big Monsters Rock shows in Europe, and we canceled off and went home. But it took me a year and a half to get clean, you know. And, you know, the, you know, that next year and a half of late 88, 89 into early 90, you know, was the transition of going deeper and darker down into the depths of addiction. And then finally in 1990, getting clean. And, you know, we had a manager who came in, his name was Ron Lafitte, and he loved Megadeth. He really got Dave as an artist. He had been a tour manager for Armored Saints back in the day and was getting into management and had worked with Rod Smallwood for a stretch. And, you know, he just loved Megadeth, and it was his goal to manage the band. And he came to us in a very gentle candor and just said, listen, you've got the whole world waiting for you. You've got the red carpet rolled out, but you got to get clean. Like, no one's going to work with you guys until you get clean. The tides have shifted in the business. Of course, at that time, you know, Aerosmith and Motley Crue and David Crosby and all these guys were getting sober, you know, and quite honestly, you know, it was pretty clear. It's like either get clean or you die, you know, and
yeah.
The music industry was no longer going to be throwing millions of dollars at junkie rock stars anymore. I mean, those days were over, you know, and for a brief period, Doc McGee managed us.
He told us the same thing.
Yeah, and he told us the same thing. He said, listen, you know, we expect our artists to work hard, and we're here to make a lot of money. And if you we don't care how you do it, but if you can't do it, we'll help you get help. And if you don't want the help, then there's the door, you know. And he made it very clear, and quite honestly, we couldn't get clean, and Doc had to walk away from us, and that just, of course, sent us down deeper into a hole. And then Ron Lafitte came knocking on the door, and you know, I mean, I give Ron, you know, Ron helped save my life. You know, he single-handedly, I remember one day I came home from the drug dealer, and I was just in tears, and he just said, he looked at me, and he just said, he goes, listen, David, I'll drop everything and help you get clean, but you have to want it. And I said, you know what, I'm ready, I want it. And he did, and he got, you know, drug and alcohol counselor, and, you know, me and Dave were each meeting with the guy separately, and then we'd have weekly band meetings with him. And it was pretty funny because, you know, Marty Friedman joined the band, and Marty didn't take any drugs at all. And, you know, Nick partied a little bit. Nick Menza, you know, he's, you know, not nothing crazy at all. And, you know, so here we are. These guys joined the band thinking, great, we're in Megadeth, and now we have to go to, like, drug and alcohol counseling meetings as a band, you know. You know, Marty was like, geez, I just joined the band to play guitar. I wasn't expecting all this, you know? And I'm like, well, look, Megadeth is a real rock and roll band. I mean, we're like the Sex Pistols, man, you know? And it's kind of funny because out of L.A., if you look at Motley Crue, Guns N' Roses, and Megadeth, three very different genres, but very similar lifestyles in our, you know, razor's edge, taking it right to the edge of the abyss, you know, type of living. And, you know, it's reflected in the music. It was reflected in the lifestyle. So it's kind of funny that, you know, that you know, again, our three bands rose to the, you know, top of our genres, and you know, and you know, there's sort of a fatal fascination with our bands because of that, because there's this razor's edge living.
Well, rock and roll in that purest, rawest form, when it's so, you know, exciting and dangerous and unpredictable, you know, that is kind of a thing of the past, isn't it, nowadays? Like, not to be down on new music, because there's plenty of great new music around,
yeah.
But the nature of the beast has changed, and society's changed, culture's changed, people's attitudes have changed, and that is like a bygone era now, isn't it?
It 100% is. And I, you know, it's funny because as I was, you know, and thank God the tides were turning, because, you know, I was, you know, to me, you know, sobriety was like raining on my punk rock parade. I was just kind of getting going by the late 80s. But, you know, it was. I mean, that was a transitional era right there where, you know, the industry was saying, hey, you know, we're not putting up with this anymore, you know, and it's time for people to get it together. And things became more corporate in the business. And you know, I've managed a young group, you know, who, you know, got under the Warped Tour and signed over to Hopeless Records and stuff. And it's interesting, you know, that this younger generation, like they don't even understand the generation that I grew up in. And you know, these days it's about vegan and, you know, human rights and save the animals, save the planet. You know, there's a whole different, rock and roll is about a whole different initiative now than it was back then. And the truth of it is, despite the lifestyle inside of Megadeth, You know, our lyrics never reflected that. You know, our lyrics were always of a higher level, of a higher thinking, of humanity as well. I mean, everything from Set the World Afire to Countdown to Extinction and, you know, the things that we wrote about. So it's not like we wrote a sex, drugs, and rock and roll, you know, narrative in our music. It's just that we happened to fall into that lifestyle. And, you know, if you look back on it, you know, the '80s were obviously the formative years for Megadeth sound. But it was really the '90s, you know, from Rust in Peace, Countdown, Euthanasia, Cryptic Writings. I mean, those were the big, big records in a very, you know, prolific season of the band, and also a very collaborative season. You know, that lineup that the fans call the Rust in Peace lineup, you know, that lineup was very productive, very prolific, very collaborative. And you know, that decade set the stage for the rest of Megadeth's career.
Well, a definitive era, definitive lineup, Unstoppable Records as well. And you mentioned a couple of words there, lyrics being a key one, and punk. And for me, I'm not just saying this to kiss ass, like out of the big four, Megadeth have always been and will always be my favorite, because there's just something about, particularly Dave, not to take anything away from the rest of the band, but there's something about Dave, like he's a unique dude. Forget about the guitar playing even, just the phrasing and the cadence of his vocal delivery was always out of step with a lot of other metal bands. His lyrics, as you say, very political, heart on sleeve, raw, honest, angry, hilarious, in your face. There's a real punk rock attitude to you guys, and obviously punk and hardcore inspired all of those thrash bands, but you guys, I think, really were that. You know what I mean? You could trace the lineage directly back to angry, political punk rock with Megadeth. It was always there for me in spades.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, a friend pointed out, you know, he goes, it's almost like when Dave was in Metallica, he was just a little too drunk to play those Diamond Head riffs really clean, and by nature, he created thrash metal.
By just
being a little off the rails, too just aggressive, you know, one beer too many, and just lip curled and snarling, and that created thrash metal. And I thought about it, I was like, God, you know, you're probably right. I mean, so by the time I met Dave, 6 weeks after he was out of Metallica in June of 1983, you know, the die had been cast of from his work in Metallica and certainly his budding celebrity from that band. But you know, the music that we then set out to create, and especially the last half of 1983 was a really prolific season of songwriting for Dave. And of course, I just got into Hollywood. I just met Dave, and I signed up and said, hey, you know, I'll book my star to yours and let's go, you know. And I was young, and I had, you know, spent my years in bands through the Midwest and played in jazz band in high school. So, I mean, I was ripe for the picking, and I was, you know, I was prepared to have this new band, you know, now called Megadeth, to be a platform for me to just kind of be an open slate and be a blank canvas to create on. And, you know, as Dave was, you know, writing, he would always call the bass. He'd always call me up to the very front of the band, opening a lot of the songs, having a lot of the breaks in the songs be bass driven. And, you know, being a guy like myself who played in orchestra band as a kid and played in jazz band, I understood bigger complexities of songwriting that were beyond just that of rock and roll. And as I sat with Dave and we were putting these early songs together in 1983 and early 84, you know, it reminded me more of orchestral composition than it did of for complexity epic oriented, you know, that if you sat back and closed your eyes, you could almost visualize Megadeth being a soundtrack to a visual performance as well.
Oh, completely.
And, you know, I think we're one of these bands that, you know, the concept was actually created before the band is created. You know, like I remember sitting in the apartment, you know, Dave had an upstairs apartment and me and my buddy Greg was downstairs from Dave and on Sycamore Avenue there in Hollywood, which is where we formed the band. And you know, there were more discussions about the vision than there were even moments in the rehearsal room rehearsing, you know. And because some bands come together because it's some blokes, they like each other, they have some fun playing music together, and out of it a band forms. Megadeth was the complete opposite. This was a very architected, blueprinted type of vision that then the characters were added to it to basically create, you know, what the vision was going to be, and a very different way of going about putting the band together.
A lot of history as well, man. I know you left for a time, but since 1983, you've obviously been, you know, on that path with Dave. And I mean, like, are you similar characters? Are you different characters? Do you complement each other? And like, I'm trying to picture the two of you, because he's obviously, you know, notoriously like a volatile dude. Are you a little bit hot-headed as well, or do you temper that side of him?
No. Not at all. I'm completely the opposite in that respect. And again, look, we have the same end game. We have the same end goal. Certainly our methods of getting there are very different. And you know, Dave said one time, he goes, look, if we're always going to agree on everything, then one of us is unnecessary. In partnership, it's like, look, you know, sometimes you have to agree to disagree, and you have to challenge each other and push each other. And, you know, while Dave generally tends to push ahead, sometimes I'm the one that pulls back a little bit, and it's a little bit of the yin and the yang, you know, and that's, you know, so that it's funny that we're both named Dave, you know. In fact, that was one of the first discussions we had, is how can we have two Daves in one band? Like, what are we going to do about this? Cause, and obviously Dave was going to change his name, because he was already starting to have some fame and notoriety under his own name. You know, my middle name is Warren. So we're like, should we call you War, David War? Like, what are we going to do here? So I went with David, and he went with Dave, you know, and that seemed to settle the dispute of how we were going to make that work in the band.
So I've been listening to your record today. I have to be completely honest. Whenever I hear the word covers album, I'm like, oh man, I always go in with a reservation, right? Especially when it's a double album as well. It's like double reservation. And I loved this album from start to end, man. I thought it was like faithful renditions for the large part, but then there was some really surprising and interesting deviations as well. Solid, amazing song selection, amazing guest list. I'd love to talk to you about a few of the guests. I've recently had on Dave Lombardo on the show. I just had Scott Ian on from Anthrax as well. Obviously, you've got Charlie from Anthrax on there. A couple of my old touring buddies as well, Gus G and Russ from Steel Panther. It sounds like you had a hell of a time making this. Did you do it in lockdown? Was this a lockdown record?
We did. This was definitely a lockdown record. You know, the origin of it was, we had originally scheduled for my Ellefson LP of original material to come out in October. And based on the Megadeth touring schedule that was laid out for 2020, you know, it was this little window where we could pop it out and probably toward the end of the year even get out to do a little bit of touring to support the next solo record. Well, obviously, March showed up, the world changed, everything locked down, and we continued to push out two songs that my Ellefson solo band had already recorded. One was a new original song called Simple Truth that we put out back in April, and we donated all the income from that, all the proceeds, to the Italian Red Cross COVID-19 Relief Fund. Part of that is because my band is from Italy, my recording band,
right.
My guitar player Andy and our drummer Paolo.
And they got hit really hard, didn't they, at the start of it all?
Really bad, really bad. Yeah, and originally, you know, I was going to go over right after Easter. I was going to fly to London where we mix over at Rogue Recording there. Our friend Alessio does all of our mixing up there in the Wembley area. So we were going to go over there, finish writing the record, and life would be wonderful. Well, you know, again, COVID had different plans. So we pushed out Simple Truth in April. In May, we pushed out a cover of the Post Malone song Over Now that we had already finished. And I think, to, by and large, that sort of set the stage for the sound of the Ellefson band. Like, what is this? You know, that it's heavy. It can be metal. It doesn't have to be. It can be, I kind of prefer it to be kind of categorized as rock, because that way it can be heavy rock. It could be lighter. We can do whatever we want. I don't need to be in another thrash band. I'm in the greatest thrash band in the world, which is Megadeth. So I don't need to do more of that somewhere else.
Well, that's, you know? It. And you want to jam out Beth. And I love that cover as well. Love exactly, that song.
Exactly. Well, it's funny. So, you know, as we moved into June, you know, late May, I went to, me and Dirk Rebarin went to Nashville, and we cut bass and drum tracks for the new Megadeth album. So we finally got that train out of the station, and it felt good to get that moving. And as I came home in early June, my, you know, my partner and singer here, Tom Hazer, we got on the phone and we just said, look, this October solo album thing is that it's not going to happen. We just need to push that back into 2021 so we can be realistic about setting it up properly, do some touring and properly support that. So, you know, we just said, look, why don't we do some covers? And, you know, originally, you know, it's like, look, is it a couple of digital downloads? Is it an EP? What is it? And I mean, literally within the first couple of phone calls, we had a dozen songs lined out. And I think probably the very first one we picked or that I chose was Wasted. Randy recommended Rebel Yell. And then we talked about Holiday in Cambodia. And then, you know, Tom's 10 years younger than me, so we always joke, I'm 70s Kiss, he's 80s Kiss. I'm 70s, early 80s Judas Priest, he's late 80s Judas Priest, you know? So the spread of these, you know, some of the earlier stuff, obviously Sweet, Sheer Heart Attack, BTO, those are my choices. Some of the things like Tear It Loose by Twisted Sister, Free Will Burning, and, you know, Wasp, Love Machine, those are Tom's choices. So I think we got a pretty good spread over about two decades of classic material here.
And it just sounds like you're having the best time doing it. And like, you know, playing all these songs which you love by artists which you love with your mates. That's what it's all about, right? Yeah. Especially when it's in these times when you're trapped in and it's like you're not getting to tour. It's like, let's have fun and make a fun record.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, there was kind of three points to this. One, first of all, the song is bigger than any of us, right? The song is bigger than any guest or musician on this record, right? So we're honoring Sweet and Kiss and, you know, these artists, right? And we didn't go for the obvious, you know? I mean, I think we went for deep cuts. These are just things that I just naturally chose, you know, and that Tom naturally chose. In fact, Tom's version of Beth isn't even the Peter Criss version. It's the Eric Carr version from the
from that
record, right? So, and quite honestly, I kind of stopped listening to Kiss by that point. So I didn't even know Eric Carr did a version of Beth, to be honest.
Me neither.
So who knew? But first of all, it was about the song. And even as we were mixing it, you know, I was like, listen, I don't want to just come in and just heavy metalize these songs. These are great songs. They deserve to be respected, and obviously we've played them well, we've played them properly, but let's mix them in a way that we can really bring out the heart and soul of the tune. And then second of all, obviously we want our guests to be featured. But this was not put together as an all-star record. This was my band just recording, you know, a handful of tunes, which turned out to be 19 songs. But that's what this was, right? And then as the guests started, we brought the guests in because, quite honestly, we've been doing with my David Ellison Youth Music Foundation, which is my nonprofit. Earlier this year, with the help of the Grammy Music Education Coalition, we had been doing some live streams and intended as a way to just keep our community together. You know, as tours were going away and everybody's lives were getting, you know, sort of dismantled with COVID shutdowns, the live streams helped keep us connected. So quite honestly, the guests you see on here, we're already on our speed dial from doing some of these live streams. And it was easy to reach over to them. And because we knew a lot of artists were getting pretty freaking bummed out, man. Like things were shutting down. They're, you know, Charlie, one day Tom was on the phone with Charlie Benante and, you know, was trying to figure out how to get Anthrax together because they live in three or four different cities. And how do we get together and write? And, you know, Tom just said, he goes, listen, dude, why don't you just throw some tracks down in this record me and David are working on? And it'll at least give you can at least play drums and have fun. You know, you probably already know the song, you know? So,
yep.
You know, just little things like that became a real kind of olive branch to all of us in the community. And you're right, Dave Lombardo, you know, Dave doesn't play in a lot of stuff. He's pretty selective about what he plays on. So I was actually very thrilled that he, you know, and he and I have been good friends for years, but I was just glad that he, you know, agreed to do it. And we're now putting together a video for Riff Raff.
Amazing.
So it'll be great to have us all together. Yeah.
I want to chat to you about Al in a minute and your Cheap Trick cover, talking about videos. But whilst we're still in the sort of Charlie Dave world, when you rejoin Megadeth and you go out and you do those huge big four shows, I have to ask you, because I completely dropped the ball and forgot to ask both Dave and Scott, have you got any fun tour stories and memories from those huge shows and the Sonosphere dates and traveling around the world after all those years for the first time, all four bands? Like, any happy, funny memories spring to mind from that experience and that time?
honestly, they were all great memories. I mean, that was such a big shot heard around the world. And, you know, for Metallica to sort of come down off of their mighty throne that they've been, you know, that they sit on, to come back and say, hey, you know, let's do this. It's funny, I'd actually kind of gotten word about it earlier in 2009. I was over playing bass for Tim Ripper Owens at Download. And the agents who put it together, who I've been dear friends with and at one point was Megadeth's agent, he had mentioned something to me about it. And I just kind of was like, yeah, I don't know. We'll see. it's a great idea. We'll see. And the fact that it became a reality, you know, less than a year later I was like, wow, this is super cool, you know? I think it was a moment where Metallica kind of needed to get the metal cred back again. You know, they're so big and they've been able to go explore so many different things. And I think Scott Ian's quote, you know, they said, you know, it's like we're all four brothers, you know, Metallica, Megadeth, Slayer, and Anthrax, but one of us went off to college and became Microsoft. And of course that's Metallica, you know. They I mean, how proud for us in heavy metal to have one of our brothers, you know, sit at the top of the throne next to the Rolling Stones and U2. And I mean, the biggest of the biggest of the biggest. I mean, we're so blessed in heavy metal to have one of our alumni sitting in that echelon, because it just opens the doors for all the rest of us to do so much stuff. And I think the funny thing is that, you know, the Metallica guys were having the time of their lives. You know, I mean, I remember right as we were all going to the stage to do our set in that first show in Warsaw, Poland, you know, James was out there cheering us on, like kind of like, go guys, yeah, go get them. You know, like he was our cheerleader, you know, like excited to be out there. And then a couple of days later, they extend the invitation for us to jump on stage and play Am I Evil in Sofia, Bulgaria, where we were going to be filming this event for the whole world to see it. And everybody was just giddy. We were like little kids, you know. It felt like high school battle of the band. Like, oh my God, we're all going to play together. This would be great, you know. And it really, I think in a lot of ways, it really brought back the true fun and joy of our scene, of our genre. It brought back the feeling that I had in 1983-84 when we were first going to San Francisco and debuting Megadeth. And, you know, the Exodus guys would come out, James and Kirk and Cliff would, you know, and Lars would come down to the Megadeth shows to see Dave and see us and hang out. And the whole scene was a hang, you know what I mean? There were no lines between us. It was all just a big hang. And that's exactly what it felt like with the Big Four. And I think just that camaraderie between all of us was just absolutely incredible.
I just had Brian Tatler on the show last week as well, and he was talking about when he got up to jam with you guys as well, and he was saying for him, like, you know, he'd never seen crowds like that, and he was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And they've chosen my song out of all the songs in the world. It's amazing.
Well, and when James introduced him, I remember that was at Nebworth, I think, right? James introduced him. He said, he goes, you know, a lot of you people may not know who this man is, but this man single-handedly is the reason why we're all on this stage together. And I was like, God, man, I just got goosebumps. I was just like, Jesus, he is so right, you know? And, you know, all of us, you know, we're one person off the stage, you know, and it's funny, the harder the metal band, usually kind of the more gentle and nice people are off the stage, right?
Yeah.
And then you get on stage and everybody puts their game face on and it's like being in a freaking football or a hockey match, you know what I mean? We're out for blood and we're ready to kill, you know? So it was interesting for all of us to be buddies backstage at catering and hanging out. And then we get on stage and we all got our freaking metal game faces on and we're just bringing our A game, you know, and it was just to feel the intensity and the power on that stage with all of us there, man. It was just this unstoppable force. And I'm looking at a Big Four double platinum award plaque on my wall right now, you know, and to see that crowd out there and the crowd was just so happy. I mean, every headbanger could die and go to heaven happily after those shows.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
How big and powerful and wild were the Clash of the Titans shows? And was the Big Four reunion all those years later, could you ever have imagined that, you know, all that time later, it would have been still like the thing that it is? Because those Clash of the Titans shows were big at the time, right? But like, I imagine nothing compared to the Big Four ones.
Well, Slayer and Megadeth had pretty much grown up together. I mean, Kerry King played guitar for Megadeth in our very first five debut shows back in early 84. And him going to San Francisco, because Dave was his hero, and he'll tell you this. He said, man, I saw Dave play with Metallica at the Whiskey and in Hollywood opening for Saxon. He goes, watching Dave changed my life. And so Dave is his hero from that moment. And so he plays with Megadeth. We go to San Francisco, and Kerry sees this whole different thrash metal scene up in the Bay Area. And very different from LA, totally different feel from the Sunset Strip kind of hairband, you know, motif going on down in LA. So, and fans started asking Kerry, dude, what's going on with Slayer? When's the Slayer album coming out? And I think Kerry saw the light. He saw the Holy Grail going, wow, okay. And so he went back to L.A., wiped the makeup off Slayer, changed, you know, modified their look a little bit. And I probably sped their music up because, you know, Kerry's favorite drummer was Tom Hunting from Exodus. And I think, quite honestly, Exodus was probably one of the bigger influences for Kerry going on those Megadeth trips. And so, you know, as a result, as much as Kerry didn't stay in Megadeth, Slayer became a real contender from that, you know, and Kerry saw the light, you know. So now we had four bands, because obviously Anthrax was doing their own thing, and Metallica and Dave, they were friends with Anthrax. Anthrax kind of took them in when they made their trip out to, you know, to meet Johnny Z and Megaforce in 1983. So now there's these four bands, and we're really all percolating and doing our own thing, you know. But
and inspiring each other, right?
I mean, Metallica was by far leading the charge. I mean, they really had the gusto. But, you know, so Slayer and Megadeth, we ended up going in late 85. I remember we flew to, I think it was even late 84, actually. I forgot what it was, 84, 85. We flew out to New York, and we played Labor's. We played another show in New Jersey together. So we would do a lot of shows together. So fast forward here to 1990. And our manager, Ron, comes in and says, hey, we're talking to Slayer management, and we're talking about doing this double billing, and we're going to call it, you know. And I think Dave came up with the name Clash of the Titans. I think that was his idea. And the name was available. We didn't get any grief from the movie studio or anything over it. And we couldn't use it again in 2010, by the way, when I came back into the band. It was either 2010 or 11. I remember Megadeth, Slayer, Anthrax were touring again. And it was under the Jägermeister Music Tour brand, and we couldn't use Clash of the Titans because I think at that point there was a legal conflict with the name. But so 1990, we decided to go out and do it. And it was interesting because we had two pretty pivotal records, obviously Rest in Peace for Megadeth. And I think it was Seasons in the Abyss, I think, for Slayer.
Yeah.
which ironically is, I think, is probably my favorite Slayer record out of all the stuff they've ever done. It's just the one that seemed to impact me the most. And, you know, we go out, and so the combined forces allows us to go play the arenas. And of course, Metallica now on their own, they were doing sometimes two or three nights in the arenas. I mean, that's how big they were, you know. But, you know, Metallica's thrust obviously broke all these doors down for us to be able to do this. And then you know, fast forward into summer 91, and now it's Slayer, Megadeth, Anthrax, and we're able to do the arenas and the amphitheaters in North America. And, you know, but one thing that happened from that, you know, and so a couple things. One, obviously Metallica was just clearly, you know, they were just on their own, just amazing trajectory, you know, unstoppable force that they were. And, you know, so it took the combined forces of the other three of us to be able to do what Metallica was able to do on their own. And, but still, you could really see this was the pinnacle of thrash metal. And that's why when we were on Clash of the Titans in 91, you know, we were starting to write music for what would become Countdown to Extinction. And there started to be this real collective mindset inside of Megadeth with our manager, Ron, and the four band members going, okay, we have got to now really take Megadeth to the next level. We can do it. We've got the musicality. We've got the musicianship and the songwriting ability in the band to do it. And now is our chance. Of course, Queensryche was doing well, and while they weren't a thrash band, you know, they took a pretty cool heavy rock sound and had expanded it, you know, pretty dramatically into the mainstream with MTV and everything. So, you know, the opportunity was there for us to you know, go grab the ring, you know, and I think we did. You know, we really buckled down on the Countdown record, and we thought, okay, look, we don't want to abandon our thrash roots, but let's go expand beyond it and see where we can go with it. And I think we really hit the sweet spot with that record of the best of the best of what Megadeth was able to do at that time.
An amazing record, and still sounds incredible to this day. And that was the record I came in on. And then you go back and you hear the early stuff, and just such a great catalog. And you know, your most recent run, like from 13 on, since you've been back as well, I've been loving all the records you've been putting out, and just so inspiring to see that all these years later, you know, it's still like as potent and creative. And obviously you'll be back next year if things go ahead. So you'll be at Download, which will be good. I want to ask you about Al Jourgensen. That guy for me is just a larger than life mystical character. I mean, is he straight now, or does he still cut loose? What's the deal with Al?
No, he's been off the heroin and everything, I think he said, for like 17 years. And, you know, it's funny because when we were on, I discovered Ministry back on the Rust in Peace tour. And
right,
I remember we were listening like Stigmata and, you know, The Mind is a Terrible Thing to Taste. And those, that, you know, that record in particular, we would listen to that. That was our house music before we went on stage. We'd listen to it backstage in the dressing room. You know, being sober, I could appreciate the sort of dark, the sort of heroin darkness that was around Ministry. You know, I could appreciate it. And what I loved about Ministry is that it had this metal quality about it, yet it had obviously the industrial thing. And I loved the repetition of the riffs and the loops and all the stuff that Al did with it. And I'm with you. I mean, I thought Al was just this larger than life guy. And sitting in the room with him, you know, I almost toured with him back in 2007 or 8. They had reached out to me, and unfortunately, I was running global artist relations for Petey at the time, and it just kind of was a conflict for me to be gone that amount of time on tour, so I wasn't able to do it. But that's when I flew out and hung out with Al and his crew out in El Paso, and we became buddies and have stayed friends ever since. And he just came through town just this last year, so I went down to go see him. And Al looked great. He was very clear-eyed. He looked great. It's funny. You know, Al's funny as hell. He's got a very funny sense of humor. And, you know, just stand on the side of the stage and just kind of, you know, be really a near bystander to the Ministry operation. It was really a treat, you know, as a fan as much as anything, and a friend to him. And so when the Al Wiedersehen thing came up, you know, Tom and I were, I think he suggested, he goes, how fucking cool would it be to get Al Jourgensen? I said, you know, I'm buddies with Al. Let me hit him. And so I, you know, I went to his organization and we made it work. And I went over to his house. I was actually in LA in July working on another record. And we set it up and I went over there and, you know, obviously we, you know, made sure everybody was COVID friendly, you know, and sat and just plugged in and did some, we kind of had guitars in hands and just did some writing and goofed off and did some playing. And Al said, he goes, man, I love your version about Beatles. And he goes, honestly, I don't know what more I can add to it. Like Tom's singing his ass off on it. And I said, well, like, do what you do, you know, like just do your thing. And he's good friends with the Chief Kirk guys. So, you know, he sent a picture. We did a little selfie and he sent it over to Robin Zander, like right away. And
love it.
Sort of got the thumbs up from Chief Kirk, you know, and it's so cool because now as we put the video out and recorded the track. And it became a single, you know, Rick Nielsen has now reshared it off of his Instagram account. So it's just, and Dax hit me, you know, Rick's son who plays drums in Chief Trick, he hit me and said, man, I love the song. So, you know, that's one of the things with this cover record is I knew as much as these guys were my heroes growing up and I'm covering their songs, we're also contemporaries and we share the same stages now as professionals. And I, part of me, I'm going, okay, look, I know KK Downing, I'm going to send him Free Will Burning. Brian May and Roger are going to hear Sheer Heart Attack and obviously Cheap Trick heard Al Wiedersehen. So it's like, I want these songs to be freaking great. You know, I want my heroes to be proud of what we did to honor them.
I just had Rob on the show as well. It's all tying together really nicely this year as we come towards the end of it. And I was reading earlier today, mm-hmm. you guys got to open up for Priest on the Painkiller tour. And that record is such a monster. How much fun did you have doing that cycle? What album were you guys on? Were you on Countdown there or on Painkiller?
That was Rust in Peace, actually. Rust in Peace had just come out. We had done the European Clash of the Titans with Slayer, Megadeth, Testament, Suicidal Tendencies. Then we came right over here to North America and we did like 3 months with Priest all across Canada, USA. We went down and did Rock in Rio in February. So we were out with Priest for, God, 3-4 months on that.
And that's just stadiums galore, is it?
Yeah, you know, all the big coliseums and sports arenas and hockey arenas. And, yeah, then the Macarena Stadium, of course, 140,000 people at Rock in Rio. And,
wow.
You know, Judas Priest is a pivotal band for me. I mean, when I heard Unleashed in the East, I was probably 16 years old. And that was a sound that changed my life. I would say certainly the Def Leppard On Through the Night record for sure, which is why we, you know, honored, you know, we covered the cover, as we say, you know, with the cover of the No Cover record.
Yeah.
And honoring, of course, the song Wasted. But then when
it's
I heard
of that is.
The East, it was, yeah, it, you know, Priest just took it to another level. I mean, their guitar tone, Rob singing. The bass playing, the double bass, you know, coming out of the gate with Exciter. I mean, every component of Judas Priest was just next level. I'd never heard anything like that, you know. And so these guys were my heroes, you know. And so to be on tour with them, sharing their stage night after night, you know, and clearly we're the next, you know, we're the next big kahuna, you know, we're the next big thing coming right up behind, you know, Judas Priest. And to become friends with them, you know, and to just be, you know, to get to know them as gentlemen. And that's where me and KK became buddies. And so as we reconnected last year and shared the stage at KK Steel Mill for that one-off show that we did, it was just so fun to, you know, to just be, you know, reconnect our friendship and have, you know, get on stage and play some tunes together again. I mean, you know, I think at this point in life, man, that's what it's about. I mean, they call it playing music. You know, and as much as these, you know, these are careers and you got to work hard at it. And there's all these things that go into a, you know, to a career, you know, at some point you step back and you go, man, am I having any fun here or not? You know, because if you're not having any fun, it's kind of a shitty job with a lot of long hours and a lot of time away from home, you know? So, you know, to me, I've always sort of checked in with myself, you know, as I'm flying, you know, in first class to Europe to start another tour going, okay, am I having fun? Because I'm really living the dream right now. This is it. I'm doing it right now. And if I'm not having fun, I really got to get my head together and check my head at the door here and not lose the plot, because it happens to all of us. You know, we're out there, you know, just pounding it so hard year after year, album after album, tour after tour. And you can lose the joy, you know, and I always, and I think things like this No Cover record, in a lot of ways, this is me coming full circle, going back to going, okay, take me back to 10-year-old David Ellefson when I heard Sweet and Kiss and Bachman Turner Overdrive on the school bus radio. Am I still in love with playing the bass and rock and roll today as much as I was then? And happily, I can say the answer is yes.
And what about AC/DC? Have you had the thumbs up of approval from them? And I love that you've gone with what I think is just one of their finest songs. You never really get it as celebrated or heard as much as you should. Power Age for me is my favorite AC/DC record. I fucking love it. And Riff Raff is just a monster. It's just a monster of a song. You've done a great version of it on the record. Have you heard back from them yet? Do they dig it?
I have not, and you know, having done some touring with AC/DC back in 2001, I know they run a very closed, tight-knit operation, and it was very revealing to us. Dave and I were asking their tour manager, you know, kind of how they run their operation, and they said, "Listen, man, we're a very big band, but we're a very small, tight-knit organization and family." And you know, you don't hear too much drama about AC/DC. We're not tabloid cover boys. You know, we keep our personal lives personal. We don't put all that out there. And I found that very commendable, you know, that they run their operation like that. Because so much of what happens in the world, especially with social media, you've got to tell everybody what coffee you had and what you ate for breakfast, and you know, in order to stay relevant. And I really commended a band like AC/DC to be so tight-knit. So I don't know if I'll hear from them. Hopefully they'll hear the song. And I certainly love the new AC/DC track that I heard, and I'm definitely looking forward to their new album next week.
Oh, man, power up. I can't wait. There's a few nice surprises arriving towards the end of the year that, you know, might save 2020 yet. And that's one of them. I love, Les, you mentioned the cover in passing a moment ago. I just have to commend the cover of this record. It's so funny. And hopefully it's done with a massive, you know, wink and a nudge, because it is just, it's a beautiful representation of what, you know, the record is, which is, as you said, it's about reconnecting to the sense of fun and joy in playing music. And I'd love to know the Def Leppard dude's response to that. I bet they would love it, wouldn't they? I bet they love it.
I hope they do. I mean, I hope they, you know, Phil Collin and I are both Jackson Guitars endorsees. And, you know, it's funny. I played bass for Ronnie Montrose. Jimmy DeGrasso called me one day and said, "Hey, we need a bass player. We're going to go do some shows opening for Def Leppard." And I suggested to Ronnie that you would be a good fit on bass, you know? And I said, "Oh man, I freaking love that first Montrose album." So I ended up doing it. And I played with Ronnie and Jimmy for about 2 years in the Montrose band. And it was so fun to go to, the first show was in Jacksonville, with Def Leppard, and, Joe and Phil came into the dressing room, and they were just such fanboys of Ronnie. And here I am, I'm a huge fanboy, not only of Ronnie, but also of Def Leppard, you know? So there's like three generations of just like rock fanboyism happening in the dressing room right there. And the Def Leppard guys were on the side of the stage watching us do the Montrose set, you know, like kids, you know, like going, like watching their hero, Ronnie, play on their stage. And so it's so great to have those moments, you know, and the Leppard guys are just so cool. And yeah, I hope they, you know, obviously, like you said, a wink and a nod, because that's what it is. We did a recreation of it because I just wanted to honor them, and especially that record of just that is a game changer, not only for me, but, you know, for Frank Cannon from Tesla, who played guitar on that song, and everybody who has been on this record. They're like, "Oh my God, Wasted. That is the song from Def Leppard. Like, that's the one we all played in our cover bands when we were teenagers." So I think we hit a real sweet spot, and as big as Def Leppard is in a sort of more kind of pop rock setting, you know, there's this other side of the early days of Def Leppard where they really changed a lot of our lives, and they're the reason that a lot of us are doing what we do today, playing rock and roll.
And they rock, don't they, man? Those early records still rock.
Yeah, they're amazing. I mean, you know, I finally got to see them play on the High and Dry tour. They opened for Blackfoot. They came to Minneapolis, where I saw a lot of shows as a kid. And it's funny, you know, Rick Savage is a bass player that I don't give him enough credit and recognition as an influence to me. Just his style, how he looks, how he plays. He's a great singer. You know, quite honestly, Tom Peterson from Cheap Trick and Rick Savage from Def Leppard are two massive influences to me, in just their style and how they play, how they look, you know, because let's face it, it's rock and roll, man. We listen with our eyes too. You know, the presentation of rock and roll is just as important as the sound of rock and roll.
On the subject of loving pastiches and cover bands and all of these things we're talking about, we have to mention, as we approach the end of the conversation, Russ from Steel Panther, better known to the world as Satchel, because that dude, I've toured with them, I've watched him up close every night, and they're obviously known as like a comedic joke band, but that dude is one of the most incredibly gifted guitarists I've ever seen. He is shit hot, isn't he? He's amazing.
Russ is one of the greatest guitar players in the world, hands down, period. And, you know, it's funny when I was literally sitting where I'm at in my office right now, where I'm doing this interview with you, and out of nowhere, across my phone, I get a notification from YouTube. It says, check out F5 Nailed to the Gun. Now, F5 was a band that I had back in the 2000s, in the couple years that I wasn't playing in Megadeth. And we did a cover of Nailed to the Gun, and I had Jimmy DeGrasso play drums on it. So we're literally putting the songs together for this no cover record. And I stop and I call Tom and go, dude, we got to do Nailed to the Gun. He's like, oh my God, I love that song. And I said, you know, Rob already sort of gave me the thumbs up from the F5 version. He was, you know, he was happy that we covered that. And right away, Tom goes, well, just dude, we got to get Russ Parrish to play guitar. He was in fight. I said, oh my God, you're right. He was. And, you know, it's funny, Russ had just played on the Altitudes and Attitude record for me and Frank Bello. I had a bass instrumental song called Leviathan, and it was just a bass riff. And our producer, Jay Rustin, he said, let me hear Russ. Let's have him put something down. And, dude, he put down a guitar part on that thing that sounds like something monumental, like off the first Michael Schenker record. You know, I mean, just mind-blowing nylon string, and then all these electric parts that he put down. And I you know, they're funny, the Steel Panther guys came to our show in Oslo back in January when we were over there with Five Finger, and it was just so great to hang with those guys, and I've seen them, of course, but to just hang with them and get some FaceTime with them. And Russ is just such a great guy. And I agree, man. He is truly one of the greatest guitar players on the planet right now. And just so honored anytime I get to work with him. And funny, he kind of got to cover himself by playing his solo on the no cover record.
He's like, yes, I've been working my whole life for this. I'm now the band they cover. Dude, thanks so much, man. This has been a great chat. I've really enjoyed it, and I really enjoyed the records.
You're welcome.
And I appreciate all the stories. And I'm going to get stuck into, which would you recommend out of the two sort of autobiographical books that you did? Should I start with the first one, go in on that first?
With that one, because it's funny, the prologue starts at Donington in 1988, and especially for you being in the UK, and you know, it's funny, every time we come back to play Download, I stand on that stage, and you know, as a sober guy, you know, part of my amends to the fans and the Megadeth is, you know, don't take drugs anymore, you know, like shoot up, show up, don't cancel shows, be there, you know. And I stand on that stage at Donington every time we play there, and it's sort of a trip down memory lane, you know, and I get to kind of revisit my past when I was at absolutely my lowest point in my life and my career, you know, strung out on drugs, stealing my dream and stealing everything from us. And then I get to stand on that stage victorious in front of 85,000 people again and just go, you know, thank you, God, for another day, you know, and it's just a really cool thing. So Download is always a kind of a really victorious home sweet home for me.
Amazing. Well, I'll bust through that, and I'll come find you a Download next year, and I'll come say hello, and we'll have a little face-to-face hi, and all the best with the rest of this year. Keep busy. I know you will.
Yep.
And thanks again for giving up your time and coming on the show. It's been a treat.
Thanks, Matt. See you, man.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.